All right, I'm firmly in team this season. We'll have an asterisk by it. Firmly on team this season. We'll have an asterisk by it. And further evidence of that today is that Baylor's game against Houston has been what they're saying is postponed now. We'll see if they play that later on in the year. But it's the second straight week Baylor has had a game postponed against a second different opponent. They'll now prepare for their fourth different season opening opponent as they try to get a game in with Kansas next week. We'll see if that actually happens because this game, it was all about contact tracing, not positive tests that actually prevented it from happening. So that could still linger into next week. We have had 29 games actually played in FBS football this year, 16 that have been canceled or postponed. It's not a normal year. It's not going to be a normal year. And as we heard Chris Klieman say on the coaches show last night, K-State was missing upwards of 40 players last week based on COVID and everything that was happening, which is why it almost didn't happen. And to me, it's not fair to fully judge these coaches based on what is happening this year. If this is any indication that it's going to go this way the rest of the year, which I would tell you it absolutely is. So by the end of this year, it's going to be an asterisk year, which should calm you about the start that K-State had against Arkansas State last week. Now, having said all of that, it's still very possible that K-State wins five or six games. And that's because of the rest of the league, man. Like, take a look around at the landscape of the rest of the Big 12. It's really easy to get sucked into your own world. We all do it, right? We're very selfish. You think about your own problems, and you don't look enough at the problems of other people. Sometimes it takes you, like, getting a step back and looking at, okay, look at what everybody else is dealing with here. Give yourself a little bit of gratitude and help you realize, in this case, that there will be a lot of winnable games left on the schedule because everybody else has problems too. Baylor now has a new head coach who did not get spring ball with his team. He did not get as much conditioning and just workouts in the summer as you typically would to have the strength coach really establish the culture of a program. Oh, by the way, Dave Aranda is a first-time head coach, so he will be learning things on the fly himself anyway. He's now preparing for a fourth different season opener. They've used all this different time preparing for Louisiana Tech, Ole Miss, and Houston. Now those games aren't going to happen. And on top of that, the thing that makes this engine go for Baylor is their offense, because the defense that was so good from last year lost almost everybody. And now the trigger man to that offense, Charlie Brewer, your quarterback is one hit to the head away from his career probably being over, because he had multiple head injuries and a neck injury last year. Like, that's not a good tenable situation. I know Baylor has talent, but that's not anything resembling stable. It's like a bridge built out of balsa wood, man. That's not anything stable. So you think that game isn't winnable? I mean, it is November 28th, and who knows what the world is going to look like on November 28th. But you think that game against Baylor isn't winnable? Absolutely it's winnable. I don't care that K-State just lost to Arkansas State. Depending on what the circumstances will be and who has what players, that's 100% a winnable game. And then the rest of the league. All we've heard this week is how bad the Big 12 is. I mean, that should be your ammo to come back and say, well, then that means, I mean, K-State should be able to win some games, right? Like, I don't think K-State had the worst performance in the league in week one. Look around at Kansas. Obviously, the Kansas game is going to be winnable. Whatever your preconceived notions were about Les Miles' team going into this year, I'd say that they were confirmed based on what we saw in week one. Falling behind 28-0 to Coastal Carolina. Being absolutely embarrassed by another team from the Sun Belt. Kansas is not good. You smashed them last year. They embarrassed themselves and threw up all over themselves in week one. That's a winnable game. Iowa State. Stan Weber had the great quote that will live in infamy forever. K-State always beats Iowa State. And on top of that, Iowa State is stumbling out of the blocks once again. Saw that last week. Lose by 17 at home to Louisiana. That's not a game that looks really overly imposing right now either. It's a winnable game. The Iowa State game is a winnable game. Texas Tech had an even worse performance than Iowa State. I don't care that they won. Houston Baptist plays their games with a CBS taking over half of their stadium. Not a Walgreens, but a CBS. That's the team that Texas Tech was a two-point conversion away from going to overtime with in their season opener. Ian Boyd came on here, who watched all the film of all the Big 12 games, and said Texas Tech might be the worst team in the league. It might be worse than Kansas. It's a winnable game. We haven't seen TCU yet. They're not going to play until next week if they get that game in. TCU already lost Max Duggan for the season. And that's been their problem, is quarterback. And they took some lumps with him at quarterback last year, thinking, all right, we have our guy for the future. He's going to be out for potentially the entire year. You think TCU is going to be a good, formidable opponent this year? You think they're definitively better than K-State right now? They're not. They're not, because they don't have a quarterback. They'll have a defense that I'm sure will keep them in games, but their offense, all kinds of question marks right now. And we still have not seen them play. West Virginia, yes, they did upset you last year. Yes, that was with Jarrett Daigie, who they've turned their quarterback situation over to now. But all West Virginia's done this year is beat Eastern Kentucky. Now, they beat them like a drum, but they actually beat them by less than Marshall beat them. Marshall in week one. AKA, that win doesn't really prove anything to us. We don't know that Neil Brown's West Virginia team this year is definitively better than K-State's. Those are all winnable games, man. What did I just rattle off there? Baylor, Kansas, Iowa State, Texas Tech, TCU, West Virginia. I've got that as six games. Six games that are very winnable for K-State left on this schedule here. I'm not saying they're going to win all of those games, but really, the only games that you look at right now and say, all right, probably out of reach, Oklahoma, which, yes, is coming up next, Texas, and then Oklahoma State. Still have not seen them play, but I imagine even after all the offseason turmoil, their talent will shine through against Tulsa. More on that game later on. I think it'll show up tomorrow, and you'll see Oklahoma State look pretty good. That'll probably be a game that's out of reach. Last year, that game wasn't particularly close. But there are six games that are very winnable. If you think this is automatically, hey, pull the plug on this thing because you lost to Arkansas State, it's going to be a 2 or 3 win season, I'm not here for that. I'm also not here for making sweeping judgments off of what happens this year, as I've clearly established this week, but I'm also not here writing off any level of fun happening the rest of the year if these games do get played, because the landscape of the league right now would indicate that K-State absolutely has a chance to still go out there and win some games. I want to bring up this story real quick, and this is not something that I would typically be using in an open of the hour segment here, but like this blows me away, and it's so disappointing. And so, it's just embarrassing for the state of Kansas. It really is. I'm about to talk some Bethany football, all right? And I'm not here to break down the KCAC. I'm not here to break down the Swedes, but I am here to break down a great article with some tremendous journalism by Taylor Eldridge of the Wichita Eagle, one of Kellis's cohorts. In fact, I meant to ask Kellis about this, and I totally forgot. What's going on at Bethany is an embarrassment. They fired their head coach less than 2 weeks before the start of this season. And I remember seeing that headline and thinking, like, all right, yeah, I mean, that's pretty weird. Like, what? Under no circumstance, outside of a giant scandal, is that really an appropriate thing to do? I mean, there's no way. Like, football, it is far too complicated to try and bring in a head coach that will... It's not a fair situation to anybody. It's not a fair situation to the new head coach or the players. Obviously, the old head coach as well. If you're going to fire somebody less than 2 weeks before the scheduled start of a season, it gets weirder. Not only was that guy fired less than 2 weeks before the start of the season, he was replaced on the same day by the offensive line coach from somebody else in the KCAC. They had a coach ready to go who was an assistant at another school in the league. I believe it was at St. Mary. So September 1st, they get rid of Corinne White as the head coach there. Well, why does this happen? Basically, the journalism done here, it's a bunch of interviews with players and coaches and those associated with the program. Not anybody actually from Bethany on the administration side, because they have not offered any kind of a comment, didn't respond to any requests for interviews here. So what we're left with is the story of the guys on the team. And basically what we have here is a situation where there was a player a receiver who was kicked out of school, and that very much upset the players on the football team. And the player was kicked out for violations of basically a mask policy. It was accusations that he had violated a three-strike policy on COVID-19. Black wide receiver in this town of pretty much all white folks. And he admitted to the first instance of it actually happening where he had a pizza delivered, but then said he disputed the other two, and it was just he said, she said, the university said, you're gone. So the head coach here, Coran White, organized a plan to march down to the administrative offices, and he was able to get the president of the school to come out and talk to the players, and then the decision was reversed. Seems good, right? This guy actually helped bring upon some change, where they were all of a sudden kicking this guy out who was there from Florida, black kid from Florida there to play football, kicking him out because of whatever eyewitness counts were there. And they get it reversed. But then all of a sudden, weeks later, he is fired. No idea why. Had a perfectly fine first season. He was 4-6 at a program that has had one winning season since 2011. White went 4-6. They won three games in the last month of the season. Obviously, you'd think in somebody's first year, that's an indication that success is coming. Point of reference, Paul Hubbard, the previous coach, he got 4 years as head coach despite producing no winning seasons and an 11-32 overall record. So there's no argument here that this is performance-based. Pretty clear that this is a vendetta about the charge being led down to the administrative offices to get this receiver like reinstated to school. That is just deplorable on a number of levels. It's not fair to anybody on the team. You have all these kids on the team now who are stuck, like wanting to transfer, wondering what they should do. It's not fair to this poor new coach that they brought in and had lined up. I mean, my God, like, could you be a little less transparent by not having a coach from the league, like, ready to go right away the day that you actually fire that guy? Like, just all reeks. And it's not fair to that coach. It's not fair to the players. Obviously, it's not fair to Coran White. It's not fair to anybody in this situation. And that is, I mean, listen, it's very indicative of where we're at in society today, but that's embarrassing to be from the state of Kansas, to have that be how things are operating in small towns here in the state. We're better than that, and Bethany needs to be better than that. And thank God that the Wichita Eagle and Taylor Eldridge is there to tell the story. I mean, I'm seeing today, I don't even remember what blowhard gas bag it was, but somebody saying that, like, yeah, you can't trust anybody with a journalism degree in this country. And, you know, I had my little quip on Twitter, but, like, you know, the same day that that's happening nationally, we have this happening here in our state where Taylor Eldridge does a great journalistic job to bring light to this story that I certainly wouldn't have been talking about it here to you had I not seen that. That's why journalism is important, man. And the watchdog is important so that schools like Bethany can't get off doing crap like this without people knowing about it. It's terrible. It's absolutely brutal. And, hey, tip of the cap to Taylor. I hope that Coran White still out there looking for a job. I certainly hope that he is able to get a job. One question he had raised was like, will I be able to get another job? Because nobody has heard of a coach getting fired less than 2 weeks before a season. How do I explain that in a job interview? I don't know. I don't know how you explain it, but at least now you have this story from the Wichita Eagle you can hand to somebody and say, here's our side of the story. Bethany, conspicuously quiet. Conspicuously quiet on all this. That's awful. All right, coaches are human. We have some proof of that. Plus, if you lost money with John in Vegas last week, I'm here to make it back for you, all right? We're back this week, baby. John in Vegas next. I'm not going to lie, college football coaches and just football coaches in general, I always, like, they're on a pedestal in terms of the work ethic that they have and everything that they have to balance and all the plates that they have to, you know, spin and everything that they have to juggle and keep all of that going. it's insane the amount of stuff that they take on, and it seems like it's just an impossible amount of work that they are always dealing, especially at the college level, with. Because not only are you meticulously going through your game plan for the week and trying to win games now, but you're recruiting and you're hosting recruits and all of this. And I as a mere mortal, I can't imagine having to balance that many things, all the while overlooking like the behavior of like 100 kids in your program and everything that goes along with that. I actually had a moment today when I was reading something that Derek Young pointed out on K-State Online where I thought, man, college football coaches just became relatable. They just actually became relatable to me. Where before this, I'd be very hard-pressed to find a moment or something that makes them all that relatable. I mean, yes, I get it. I see Andy Reid. He loves cheeseburgers. You know, I know the Kansas City media has been all over that here over the last week and stuff. Like, yes, okay, that's relatable. Andy Reid likes Five Guys. I like Five Guys. Sounds very good right now. I'm quite hungry. But on a real level, like what they do and the job that they have to handle, like I can't find that very relatable. As busy as I am, it doesn't even compare. But then I read this. Derek points out that the dead period in college football recruiting was once again extended by the Division I Council. So basically, recruiting, like you will not be able to go travel to see recruits or have recruits come travel to see you. There's no visits going on during the season. And when you see that, at first you'd think, okay, well, this has to be like college coaches are going to be very upset about this, right? Like, I'm sure they want things to get back to normal. We're playing games. But Derek says that's not the case. He says, for those that think this is an overreaction and unnecessary, your college coaches are the ones who you have a beef with. They don't want anyone coming into their football buildings from the outside that may have the opportunity to disrupt the season, spread the virus, etc. But then also, he says it takes so much time and energy to even have a college football season that many do not think that they have the time, energy, and manpower to properly conduct recruiting visits at this point, and surely don't have it to make trips and hit the road and evaluate. And that's the moment where I'm like, man, college football coaches just actually became relatable. Instead of these superhuman cyborgs that are able to balance all of these things that I could just never imagine being able to actually take into account, here's a moment where they're saying, like, enough. Like, we are dealing with the social justice climate of the country right now, everything that comes with that. You know, we're dealing with, listen, we just wore Black Lives Matter patches on our jerseys this past week. And yes, I know about all of you that have called the athletic department, everybody complaining about that in the last week. I won't even start to go down that road because I don't know that I have the energy in me. But I know that it was an issue, and I know that that's something they're having to deal with. I know that COVID is something they're dealing with. Chris Klieman doesn't know who's practicing on a day-to-day basis, a week-to-week basis. He's got upwards of 40 guys out for the season opener. All of that, finally, they said enough. I can't handle recruiting on top of it. I can't handle dealing with the typical recruiting calendar and having guys in for visits and all of that. Well, I'm still trying to win games because a lot of people in my fan base are going to slaughter me on social media if I go out and lose still to Arkansas State. Enough is enough. I don't want to deal with that. I applaud them for it. I mean, I understand, like, I don't want kids to be hurt here, but recruiting will still happen in some form or fashion. And now that it looks like the Big Ten and the Pac-12 are actually going to play, it seems like that recruiting calendar will be fairly synced up by the end of the fall, like once we get to December. So I think the kids will be fine. This seems like a good move just for the sanity of everybody involved, in particular the coaches. And it's a rare, relatable moment for me to these college football coaches and saying, like, dude, I don't have it in me. I can't. I mean, we all have those days where it's like, I couldn't take one more thing being put on my plate right now. I understand how that goes. And, hey, I hope these coaches, man, I hope they've got good therapists. I hope they've got somebody who can help calm them down at the end of the day. I hope they've got some good whiskey, some good bourbon, because that is a ton to deal with. You know, you may need some, too, if you followed my John in Vegas picks last week. I'm not here to offer up apologies because it's a long season, all right? I will have plenty of excuses to offer up to you because it is an asterisk year. That goes for John in Vegas as well. So I'm going to go ahead and add that as a preview to what I'm about to give you for my picks this week. But I did go 0-4. And I'm not getting into the specific games again because I did that yesterday. But I have some John in Vegas picks for you this week against the spread. No over-unders, all against the spread this week in college football. So here goes nothing. First up, I've got Oklahoma State and Tulsa. The Cowboys are finally going to start their season. It's a week later than what was anticipated as the game got pushed from last week. They're 23-point favorites, according to Vegas Insider, over Tulsa, and I'm taking Oklahoma State to cover here. So Tulsa is 5-15-1 against the Big 12 in their last 21 games. They have not been very good is the point there. They've been beaten down by many a Big 12 team. And Tulsa just did, fairly recently, deal with a 9-day pause in their camp because of COVID. So they've been hit pretty hard on a relative scale. And if there were any chance that Oklahoma State was going to take Tulsa for granted, was going to take Tulsa lightly, last week should have removed any doubt that that was going to happen by Oklahoma State just looking around the rest of the league and seeing what happened to K-State, Iowa State, Kansas, and to a lesser extent, Texas Tech. That's a pretty big warning shot. Oklahoma State's seen their league drugged through the mud. Those players are all on Twitter. You saw how fast Chuba Hubbard used Twitter to his advantage when he had a beef with Mike Gundy. They're on Twitter. They read it. They know. I'm sure that has their attention. I think they'll be focused. I think they'll be explosive. I think they're a good team. I actually have them right now in the Big 12 championship game. That was in my season prediction. So I think they will go out and club Tulsa and win by 4+ touchdowns. There's John in Vegas pick number one. The best game of the weekend is Miami and Louisville. And I've got a pick here. And if you've listened to the show for a while, you know, I've got a soft spot for the U. You know, I got a soft spot for the U, especially back in the day. Classic Miami football. That's right up my alley, baby. And I'm taking Miami +2.5 at Louisville. Wrong team favored here. It should be Miami and Derek King, who wasn't even that great in Miami's season opener, but still key to rushing attack to put up 337 yards on the ground. He's electric. Houston transfer. I think Miami's finally got a really good quarterback, and they smoked Louisville last year, 52-27. If you're thinking revenge game, I mean, okay, but Papa John's Stadium ain't going to be rocking like it would be under normal circumstances for this game. I think that mitigates some of the revenge factor there, not being able to feed off the energy at the home crowd. I just simply think Miami is flatly the better team, and the atmosphere is not going to affect things very much, so I'm taking Miami +2.5. You're giving me 2.5 points there when I think Miami's the team that would win the game straight up. This is probably my favorite pick of the weekend. It's a game that, believe it or not, will be on that SEC slot, that 2:30 CBS slot. That's where you're going to get App State and Marshall. Yes, that, more than anything else, is representative of what the college football slate is this weekend. So App State is a 5-point favorite at Marshall. They're ranked number 23 in the country. They're a very good program, 23 wins the last 2 years. Yes, their head coach from last year is now at Missouri. Yes, their head coach from 2 years ago is now at aforementioned Louisville. But there's enough residual effect there for this still to be a very, very good team and program this year. The Sun Belt is red hot, baby. We saw what the Sun Belt did to the Big 12. Here's another Sun Belt team, and this is the team that's run the Sun Belt the last couple of years. They've been the best team in the league. I think they're going to keep up what the Sun Belt has done and take advantage of a Marshall team that, yes, did beat Eastern Kentucky 59-0, but Eastern Kentucky is absolutely terrible. I don't buy anything into that from what Marshall is going to be this year. App State has been the better team, the better program. They'll be confident and cocky going into that game. I think they're more ready for a primetime game on CBS because they have played in more big games and had more national attention here recently. So I will take them to win by a touchdown plus and cover the number, which is 5 there. And finally, I those are the three picks I felt good about. John in Vegas has always been about giving you 4 picks, and I'm a trooper, damn it. And it's not a very good schedule or slate this weekend. It's hard to find a lot of things that you like, but I went and put a 4th one on here for content's sake anyway. And I figured, why not utilize the strategy that Mitch taught me once upon a time in blackjack, you know, back in my heyday of like, I don't know, like 3 months where I thought I was into blackjack. And I went to the casino with Mitch, and he was like, yeah, you know, if you lose your hand, then bet double next, and eventually, like, it's going to hit, and you'll win it all back. And I saw Mitch almost lose all his money, and then wind up winning like $500 and making it rain burritos later that night, I'm going to take that strategy here and go Clemson minus 45.5 against the Citadel. I mean, I took Clemson and the Clemson minus anything strategy last week. It didn't work out. They did not cover against Wake. I'm just going to double down on it. I don't have great reasoning for you here. The Citadel does run like a triple option offense, which theoretically would grind some clock out of this game. But, like, I'm just going to take the Mitch Fortner strategy. Double down. Go all in on it. Clemson minus anything. They'll win by 50 this weekend. And that's your fourth John in Vegas pick. So 0-4 last week, but we'll be 4-0 this week. Make it all back up and get back on track starting at the regular starting blocks next week. Now, Mitch has left me another number one song of the day. I am going to, I'm sure, dissect the absolute heck out of that coming up next. Mitch. What are you doing leaving me alone with a song from 1960 and 1962? I don't know what that means. I guess we'll find out here in this paragraph. I mean, really, it's like four paragraphs. This story that I have to read about a song from the 60s. What am I supposed to do with The Twist by Chubby Checker? It was number one for 1 week in 1960, then set a record as the only song to reach number one in two different years when it resurfaced and topped the popular Hit Parade again for 2 weeks. The Hit Parade. On January 13th, 1962. What does that say about music in the 60s? What does that say about music in the 60s when one song here is going number one in both 1960 and then in 1962? We didn't have any better songs coming out in 1962. Like, where was Elvis? Was he swinging his, was he gyrating his hips yet at this point? He couldn't cook something up that would be better than Chubby Checker, who I'm told is an American rock and roll singer and dancer from Spring Gully, South Carolina. Believe it or not, well, I can believe it, Mitch, because I'm reading what you've written here. Believe it or not, Chubby Checker is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Oh, well, I mean, I'm shocked. Just can't imagine. In 2002, he protested outside of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony over the lack of radio airplay of The Twist, and the Hall of Fame snubbed him. So, wait, hold on. He protested not being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but over lack of radio airplay, but yet this was number one for 3 weeks in two different years. What does this guy think he is? Chubby Checker? Your name's Chubby. It's about appearances. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame can't be throwing somebody named Chubby Checker into the... we'll just let any old slap in if that's what we're going to do. He's got five top tens and the first of his two number ones. So this is... I mean, shocker. How many of these songs are covers? It says Checker's version is actually a cover. It was originally written by Hank Ballard, who recorded it in 1959 with his group The Midnighters. Well, The Midnighters should be getting the credit then for this. Ballard got the idea for the song by watching The Midnighters on stage. This sounds exactly like the guy yesterday. Who was the guy yesterday? Who was just sitting there trying to copy songs? Rob Parisi. What are you doing, Rob? Rob Parisi, who should get no credit, never be heard from again in the music world because he was sitting around trying to copy everybody. It sounds like he's got a fellow pee in the pod here with Chubby Checker. Just trying to copy the Midnighters. Man, Midnighters were great. Shout out to the Midnighters. To Hank, the group often moved on stage like they were trying to put a cigarette out. In a sense, they were twisting, thus the title of the song, The Twist. Very, very clever. On August 6, 1960, the song became an overnight national sensation after Checker performed it on American Bandstand. What is American Bandstand? Dick Clark, host of the national American Bandstand, attempted to hook Ballard to perform on the show. Ballard was on, okay, all right, whatever. Dick Clark, he's a famous guy. In late 1961, early 1962, the Twist dance craze would take off. It popularized a style of dancing where participants didn't touch each other, which became a new trend, especially with disco dancing. So the trend here is that they didn't touch each other, but that was new? I would think nobody would be touching anybody because, like, Elvis started moving his hips and, you know, everyone's heads exploded. You know, like Tipper Gore was trying to slap a parental advisory on the hips of Elvis Presley. I'm getting some references mixed up there, maybe. But I... All right. Whatever. Popularized new dance trend. This song is ranked number 451 on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Sometimes I feel like sometimes at the end of these, it's like we get a list of the 100 greatest songs of all time. Now it's the 500 greatest songs of all time. How far are we going to expand this and broaden this? Like, can Soulja Boy be on the 1,000 greatest songs of all time? Can we just make that happen at some point here? And if you think I'm done, I'm not done. There's still more text here to read. According to Billboard, The Twist held the honor of being the number one song on its Hot 150th anniversary list of the Billboard All-Time Hot 100. Okay, great. Checker is also the father of basketball player Misty Bass, who had a 10-year run in the WNBA. All right. I mean, that's cool. But it sounds like this guy copied a song. And it sounds like this guy is a fraud, just like Rob Parisi. Rob Parisi and Chubby Checker. Two guys cheating their way to the top. Into the Week Sound Extravaganza is next. Gotta let this build a little bit. This is the proper way to take you into the weekend. Some party rock anthem. LMFAO. It's the backdrop for the best sounds of the week. Yes, this is a tradition that will continue despite the fact that I do not have Mitch Fortner here and that Mason is gone now. We still do funny things throughout the week like this. That Jamie Pollard made a simple mistake. He meant Iowa State would win 40% of its games this year, not allow 40% attendance. Yes, my 30 for 30. Very proud of that. Many compliments have come pouring in since then, all right? Many saying it's the best 30 for 30 ever. How about that? That when you only complete 46% of your passes against a team from the Sun Belt, it's pretty hard to win a Heisman. You know, that's the crowning achievement of the whole thing, is that line right there, because not only is it incredibly clever, showcasing the wit that I have, but it also utilizes a pretty terrible pun, which I'm a sucker for terrible puns. That when you only complete 46% of your passes against a team from the Sun Belt, it's pretty hard to win a Heisman. Oh, it's just got John written all over it. I love it. Now, we didn't do this last week, so I'm going to let you in on a secret here. I cheated. I went back to something from a couple of weeks ago that never got its fair due.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity.
I tell you what, I don't know what it is about Amish paradise, but it still gets me going. Like, every time I hear that, I mean, I'm just ready to keep going at 4:30 in the morning. I'm milking cows, Jebediah feeds the chickens, and Jacob plows. And I can just keep going with the whole song. Poor Coolio in Gangster's Paradise, it got totally overshadowed by my incredible performance of singing / rapping along to Amish Paradise.
A local boy kicked me in the butt last week. I just smiled at him and I turned the other cheek. I really don't care, in fact I wish him well, cause I'll be laughing my head off when he's burning in hell.
Not good for my street cred, but I don't care. I mean, I like it. I just like it too much. I like it too much. Sometimes you like things that you know aren't cool. We've already established here today on the show, I'm not very cool anymore because I missed the boat on TikTok officially. It is quite literally, there are stands on one half, the other side is a CVS and CVS parking lot. Wow. I mean, it's like nestled into a CVS. That's where Houston Baptist plays. My favorite fact of the week, my favorite fact of college football so far is that Houston Baptist almost beat Texas Tech, and Houston Baptist plays their football games basically in a CVS parking lot. Not even a joke. Go look it up on my Twitter account at J.O. Kurtz.
You jabronis hit the jackpot.
That jabroni you have sitting in your studio.
Ow.
Is this jabroni's name?
Jabroni of the week.
Ah, yes.
Indeed, yes. Thank you for that at the end there, Mitch. Jabroni of the week made its triumphant return this week after a hiatus, I don't know, since February. 7-month-long hiatus. Mitch determined that he could not appropriately do it during the pandemic. So Jabroni of the Week is back. It was the Bengals kicker who seemed to, redeem himself last night. I don't know. I didn't watch the whole game. I saw he hit a field goal early. Here might be my favorite moment of the week.
I would much rather have those other two games on a real network than the trash it was on the other night.
Yeah, man.
Being honest. That's the truth.
Wyatt Thompson taking out the Longhorn Network /pay-per-view. Oklahoma on pay-per-view and Texas on the Longhorn Network. That was clearly something that did not benefit the Big 12 last week. They played well. Nobody could actually see the games.
Daniel Sands. Javon Thomas.
You know I have to work in my new imaging here. Whenever I put something together, it's going to get a lot of run on the show because I'm proud. I need to show it off. I need the attention. That, of course, is from the new My Guy Curse Imaging. I was able to find like a little Darth Vader voice effect to throw the names of Javon Thomas and Daniel Sams and Donovan Williams. All the My Guys that have ever existed underneath that haunting bed. This was probably the best revelation we had this week, and it didn't get talked about enough.
There was one that we were in a trips receiver set, a bunch set, I was at the point of the bunch, and then Lockett and whoever our third receiver was were back behind me, and we threw a bubble screen to Lockett that was a backwards pass, and then I would have gone out and acted like I was going to stock block and then release down the sideline, and we practiced that a couple times a day, and always were on Coach Kimmel to get that in the game script, but it never made it.
Of course, that is Curry Sexton describing that Tyler Lockett had a play designed up for him that was practiced all the time where he'd be the quarterback. He'd take the double pass, throw it to Curry Sexton, but Dana Dimmel never actually got it out there on the field. All that complaining everybody did about Dana Dimmel for so long, that's the real complaint we should have, that we never got to see Tyler Lockett actually throw the football. And if you guys know me, of all the things that happened this week, what do you think I would end the show on? How do you think I would go out? What's the appropriate way for this show to go out this week?
You!
Soulja Boy Tough.
I can just hear that over and over again. That thing kicks in. You hear that Yule at the beginning of the song, like I'm just going to dance. I need a Bud Light Lemonade stat.
You!
Soulja Boy Tough.
God, I love Soulja Boy. You know, that song, I still contend, as popular as any in my lifetime, as I have been alive with my age group at the time, my freshman year of college. We had practiced this. Like, I spent probably 10 hours learning this dance and practicing it all together.
And how'd it work out for you?
Oh, we crushed it, man. I mean, not me so much individually, but as a group, we were great. I didn't say in that story there that I was actually positioned purposely in the back. We were in, like, a big square formation. I was in the back row, trying to hide me. I couldn't really dance all that well. But I tell you what, slap some beers in me, give me a couple shots or something, and it'll look pretty damn good for a 31-year-old in 2020. It's going to do it for the show this week. Appreciate Steven filling in. Enjoy high school football tonight.
You!
Soulja Boy Tough.